Good morning. The Senate Committee on Human Services come to order. It is Friday, January 12th, the end of the first legislative days of the year of practice for coming back every day and spending time together in January. We have two informational hearings and some public hearings on the legislative concepts. And just for those that are listening, I know that we have the sign-up sheets out here, but can we leave them out so people can continue signing up if they need to? And I know some Post is going to come on LC-120. So if you're around and listening, the plan in this short session is that we will be posting these three bills. We've been talking about them in September and November and again today. So we will post them for a public hearing and work session those very first 2 days of session. So it's really important if you have concerns to get those concerns on the record today so that those can be introduced in the next couple of weeks and we're ready to take action on that second day of the legislative session so we can keep the calendar moving along. And that is why we have these public hearings. If we don't hear from you on the record, we can't know that you have issues and concerns. All right, so we're going to start with our informational hearing, and we'll start with an informational hearing on the safety in the Oregon child care system. And while you are heading up, I wanted to acknowledge our committee has had a little bit of a transformation. We have two new members, one that has a name, one that will be decided by the Tri-County Commissioners soon. But Senator Linthicum, do you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Chair. My name's Dennis Linthicum. I am a Senate District 28 Senator, and that includes parts of Jackson County, Klamath County, Lake County, a sliver of Deschutes County, and all of Crook County.
Excellent. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So, welcome.
Thank you. Sure. Good morning. For the record, my name is Dawn Woods, and I'm the child care director for the Early Learning Division.
Good morning. My name is Miriam Galeron. I'm the Early Learning System Director for the Early Learning Division, and want to say that Dawn and I did not color coordinate or plan our outfits this morning. But thank you so much for the opportunity to speak this morning and talk about our efforts to strengthen our licensing program at the Office of Child Care, including our collaboration with DHS, and also share information about our agency request for the 2018 session. Do the slide. So first I thought would and give a little bit of background about the Early Learning Division. The Early Learning Division has the responsibility to administer key programs that support young children and families in our state. We administer and oversee certain home visiting programs, preschool education, parenting education programs, and also our Office of Child Care has responsibility for our licensing program and programs that support providers and work to increase the supply of quality child care in our state. I talk a little bit as well about the funding specifically for child care in our state. As you'll see from this slide here, the majority of the funding that we receive to support child care is federal funding, about $138 million, and then we have some general fund investment. Together, this fund has really three main purposes. One is to help low-income families afford child care, so about $96 million of these resources are transferred to DHS for those purposes. The remaining resources at the Early Learning Division support our SPARC system, which is our quality rating and improvement system, where we provide technical assistance to providers and incentives to increase the quality of child care. It also supports our professional development system, the efforts and the investments we make to help providers increase their training, their skills, knowledge for working with young children, as well as in the supports for regulating child care in our state. Both the Early Learning Division and the Department of Human Services jointly administer key programs that comprise the child care system. As you can see from the slide here, the Department of Human Services is responsible for overseeing the child care assistance program, employment-related daycare. They also have responsibility for investigating allegations of abuse in child care in our state, and we partner with them in those efforts. The ELD is responsible for licensing child care facilities facilities. So we have regulations that largely focus on the health and safety of child care, as well as certifying individuals who work in licensed child care in our state. And I already mentioned some of the key programs that we do that support providers around quality and professional development. I'm going to ask Dawn to talk a little bit more specifically about our licensing program and caseloads.
So good morning. I think last session, for those that were on the committee, we came and talked a little bit about some of the reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant Fund that the Oregon receives. And our current caseloads, prior to this reauthorization of CCDF, we were about 1 to 100. I think on the slide last session, it was like 1 to 97. The best practices from caring for our children is a 1 to 50 caseload. Currently, with the new monitoring requirements, we are now at a caseload of 1 to 150. We now do on-site monitoring for the license-exempt providers receiving ERDC subsidy. We have 46 licensing specialists across the state located in 7 field offices. We license about 4,200 child care facilities. Those are both in homes, which is a large majority, as well as more traditional center-based, as well as the new regulated subsidy is roughly, and this is really a moving number, about 2,700 homes that are caring for fewer than 3 children that are on ERDC or the employment-related daycare. On top of the caseload, our licensing specialists go out and investigate illegal care complaints. And so just to give you some kind of statistics around there, in 2016, we investigated 225 illegal care, and in 17, 165 possible illegal care. In 2016, and that's actually when I came in to be the director of child care, prior to that, the early learning division had requested an internal audit, really looking at our practices around legal and compliance to ensure that the health and safety of children were being met. So when it really kind of became my playbook when I came into this position, and through that, we made significant leadership changes, some management changes, as well as really began a project to replace our really antiquated data system, which also then would feed into a parent portal allowing us to provide families with a lot more information on either their existing child care program or any child care program that they might be considering. In 2017, House Bill 2259, which allowed us to conduct extensive background checks on all individuals, which was a part of the federal requirement, the new federal law. We doubled our unannounced inspections within the family child care home, which is the majority of child care facilities. We, in 2016 to 2017, we have more than doubled our enforcement actions in terms of shutting down programs that have been providing, have had a real chronic history of rule violations. We also formed a statutory work group that was really also based on that internal audit, which we'll actually talk about a little bit more, that is really kind of leading to some legislation this session in order to give us some more enforcement tools, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then also in the last session, House Bill 2260 was also passed, which gave us the statutory ability to provide more consumer information and transparency, again, which falls in line with the reauthorization of CCDF. So some of the key reforms that we're really looking at in 2018 as well is we have doing and getting ready to promulgate rules of a complete overhaul of all of our licensing rules. In the past, the licensing rules were really looked at independently of each other. And so we are looking them across the board and really strengthening our rules, clarifying our rules, and really aligning the rules so that the standard of care, no matter the setting, is much more consistent. And we've also been really using the Caring for Our Children, which is really our industry standards, to kind of pressure test where we need to be in Oregon and really balance that, both the supply needed of child care and to really the health and safety of our rules. We've also been working this year in developing some new lead rules and have a funding request couched within that as well. And so all licensed child care providers and our regulated subsidy providers, which are the license exempt, are going to be required to conduct lead testing for all water sources. And really our rules are requiring stronger requirements in terms of mitigating the risk for lead exposure. We've had some, you know, in the past, but we've really strengthened them through this rule alignment work. And then our regulated subsidy providers, the license exempt, paying a fee, they're typically the neighbor. They're caring for fewer than three children. It's a neighbor, it's a friend, a family member. They typically don't have a fee in which they pay, and so really looking part of the funding request is to look at how can we pay for water testing for that population that they're caring for, often some of our most vulnerable children. So this February session, we'll be moving forward a child care safety bill, and that really is connected to the work that the statutory work group conducted. And what this allows us is for the Office of Child Care to take action when a license expires. In the past, we would lose jurisdiction if a license expired and couldn't follow through on a legal action that was underway. Also protects children from providers who had had previous significant licensing violations. It'll explicitly give us more progressive discipline for us to address those kind of historical chronic violators. It will give us the ability to issue cease and desist orders for providers, specifically on those around illegal care, as well as increase our civil penalties for both illegal care as well as other licensing violations. Currently, our limit is $100 is a civil penalty, and so this will significantly increase and create essentially a cap of around $1,500 for a civil penalty to really be more of a deterrent for providing illegal care or other violations. And it also, this bill looks to explicitly allow us to impose certain conditions on a license. So if there's a particular concern or a certain way in which we need to ensure that, you know, a certain individual maybe isn't in the home, we'll be able to put on a condition on those licenses.
Thanks. I'm going to talk a little bit about our work with DHS. So we testified before the committee in November about how the work that DHS and ELD were doing to look at our collaboration around investigations in child care facilities. I'm happy to share that work has continued. By the end of the month, we're going to have a signed intergovernmental agreement between DHS and ELD, where we'll be clarifying a lot of our existing practices and our expectations for field staff related to information sharing, screening procedures, and we've also identified really a need to be able to do joint investigations of when there are allegations of abuse in child care facilities. And we can go to the next slide. So this brings me to the request for the short session, which is 14 positions, and I'll start with five of those positions are related to the ability to be able to do joint investigations with DHS. Right now, we're working together jointly. We have about 200 active cases, and most of these cases of allegations of abuse in child care facilities are in the Tri-County area, so Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Marion, and Lane County. And so this request would really allow us to begin to pilot joint investigations in these communities. As we've looked at this issue and our collaboration with DHS, we've really come to understand that this is a investigations in child care facilities is a different practice for DHS. We've also learned that we have very complementary but different perspectives as we look at conducting these investigations. And we've also, through some of the work at Early Learning Division to look at how we take stronger enforcement actions, have really come to understand that we need more firsthand knowledge, more timely information to be able to build stronger cases when we are seeking action against a facility that has been chronically violating our child care rules. And so we are really hopeful that this pilot will be able to move the work forward and inform how we can do better investigations statewide. So those of these 14 positions that the agency is requesting in the short session, five of those positions would be dedicated to this pilot. The other nine positions will have a direct impact on lowering the caseloads that Dawn talked about, as well as enhancing our management and supervisory capacity, so that we're able to implement these new procedures and these new enforcement tools that Dawn talked about in the legislation effectively and consistently and to be able to improve the quality and safety of child care in our state. We've also got an important responsibility to help parents find safe and quality care. And so we have been looking and working on a number of different areas currently to enhance our efforts on that front. So first, we've made some recent upgrades to our current website, which houses information about facilities and their backgrounds and their history. So we've added information about fatalities and serious injuries on our current website. We also currently list all of the facilities where we've done closures or emergency suspensions. We're continuing to look at ways in which we can enhance that current website. We also believe it's very important to bring families' voice and input on some of the key decisions and reforms that we're making. So we've got a number of opportunities, listening sessions, surveys to get families' input both on our new regulations. We'll plan to do some usability testing with families on our new website, which I'll talk about in a second. And this year, we're going to be rewriting our Child Care Development Fund state plan, which is a federal requirement. And so we'll be seeking input from families as we undertake that effort. And then finally, we do maintain a hotline, and we want families to know about that resource. This is where they can make complaints about child care. They can report. Anybody in the public can report illegal care through that hotline. We also make tools available for families to help find care, give them information about quality, and they can also call the hotline and get the full history of the facility and a lot more information than they're able to access on our website right now. We're also going to be launching a new data system that Dawn talked about, and she also mentioned the family portal, the web portal that is connected to that data system. So at the end of March, we will launch ELIS, Early Learning Information System, and a parent portal connected to that. The parent portal will really give us the ability to share information with the public that currently now you have to make a phone call to our hotline to get. So this information will be searchable and accessible to families. The new website is going to give us really an ability to look at data and make data-driven decisions as we look at all of the resources we have to be able to regulate child care effectively. This project, as Dawn mentioned, began 2 years ago and was a $2 million project that we received federal funding for. And so it's really allowed us to take this very antiquated data system and convert to a very state-of-the-art data system. So we feel very fortunate about that. I think I already touched on the new parent portal, and this just basically shows you a lot of the information that currently you have to call the hotline to get, but now will be in a very user-friendly and searchable format for families on our website. So we've talked a lot about our licensing program and our responsibilities to regulate care, but it's also and I've touched on many of the important programs that we have to increase affordability to support making child care more affordable and higher quality. And I would say that by the indicators that you see here, we've got a lot more work to do to make sure that Oregon families with young children have access to affordable and high quality care. We know that there is an inadequate supply of child care in our state, particularly quality child care. We need to assist more families in being able to afford child care. The costs are unaffordable for not only low-income families, but our moderate and middle-income families as well. And we know that some of the best investments that we can make as a state to make childcare not only safer, but high quality and aligned to our kindergarten readiness goals is if we support providers and we support the childcare workforce. They are historically, everywhere in this country, including in Oregon, I think undervalued, underpaid, and a workforce that lacks access to the kinds of supports and training and professional learning opportunities that they need. So that is, I think, the together thinking about just regulation as well as our efforts to look at public investment to help address affordability and quality are the areas that we need to move forward as a state to help families with young children. So that is, I think, a good segue into what we see as next steps and the ways in which we hope we can come back and continue to work with this committee. For the short session, we'll be focused on our child care safety bill that Dawn talked about, the licensing program request, and the request for resources to support lead testing with our regulated subsidy providers. We'd like to continue to be able to come back and update the committee on our collaborative efforts with the Department of Human Services. I'd like to return with Dr. Richardson again. And then finally, I want to mention that Governor Brown has directed me and the Education Cabinet to develop a plan to finance an early care and education system, and that is the plan where we're really going to look at these issues of affordability and quality and building more early learn and ensuring more early learning access for our most vulnerable families in the state. And so that is really a plan for recommendations for the 2019 session. So we look forward to keeping you informed about all of these efforts. I think with that, we'll open it up to questions.
Thank you. Are there questions?
No, it's just a big ask. And so the Ways and Means is going to have, hopefully, be able to address the needs of the child care division.
Do you know, will that go to the human services sub or to the education sub? Do you know where that ask is?
The letter will be sent today from Governor Brown, and it's going to Ways and Means co-chairs, I believe.
But do you know which sub?
Education.
Which subcommittee?
Education. Education. Okay. But we'll make sure, Senator, that you get copies and the committee gets copies of the letter.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you
very
so much.
And thank you
thank
for
you.
Your leadership of the program. We're going to jump ahead because I see that Representative Post is in the room, and then we can let him go back to his other committees and activities. So we are going to close the informational meeting on safety in the Oregon child care system and open up a public hearing on LC 120. And I am going to join Representative Post down below.
Please proceed.
I was waiting for that.
Do you want to go first?
You know, I think you should.
Okay. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelster. I'm the state senator from Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, and the surrounding areas, Senate District 8. We are here today with LC 120, which is a fairly comprehensive bill. It does two particular things. There's a piece that Representative Post and I have come together. As you all know, Representative Post and I share very similar views on adolescent sexuality, and that is why we have a Post-Gelster bill on teen sex. So, In the fall of this school year, we started to receive communications from students and staff of the Salem-Keizer School District who were concerned about an unusual and relatively unprecedented interpretation of the mandatory child abuse reporting law. What staff were told by their school district was that they were required to call law enforcement or the child abuse hotline anytime they became aware of any consensual sexual contact between teenagers. This could include sexual intercourse. This could include kissing. This would result in a number of problems. One, an overwhelming number of telephone calls to the child abuse hotline every time there was a middle school dance or homecoming or prom or passing period in a high school if you've ever seen the extreme displays of public affection in hallways in between classes at a high school. The other problem is that it shut down the ability for parents, teachers, school nurses, school counselors to have conversations with young people about issues like consent, sexuality, and birth control. It also runs counter to our state's policy around age-appropriate and medically accurate sex education. The extra twist to this information that was given to the Salem-Keizer School District was that, as all of us, and we learned this in our training the other day, we are mandatory reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the staff was told that if they became aware that their own children were having sexual contact and they were under the age of 18, they were also required to make those reports to the child abuse hotline. So we talked with the Marion County District Attorney, we talked with the Legislative Council, we talked with the Department of Justice. And although for decades this has not been the common sense interpretation of the law, we cannot explicitly state in the statute that it tells you that you do not have to call when that happens. We did get confirmation from the Marion County DA that they have never prosecuted an individual for failing to report when two 16-year-olds make out in the back of their car or even have sex with each other when it is consensual. And we also were able to confirm that a pair of 16-year-olds having consensual sexual contact with one another have never been criminally prosecuted for that consensual behavior with one another. So we went back, we talked to the Salem-Keizer School District, we asked if they could step back on this guidance. They said no, not without legislation. We also asked if, once we agreed to work on this legislation and had language, if they would put a halt to that interpretation for this school year, given that it would be a major change in practice from what they had done in the past, and they also said no. So that is currently the state of affairs in the Salem-Keizer School District for Salem-Keizer students. So what we have for you is this bill that, in the first part, and I will tell you what the second part does in a second, simply says that if you are a mandatory reporter, you are not required to report consensual sexual activity between 14 and 21-year-olds as long as there is not a greater than 3-year age difference between them and it was otherwise consensual, that there was no force or coercion. With this legislation, of course, we would still have a mandatory report if a 20-year-old was having sex with a 14-year-old or if a 17-year-old was having sex with a 12-year-old. Of course, we would still have mandatory reporting if there was concern that there had been alcohol, an abuse of power, any sort of lack of consent. But what this does is puts these conversations back where they need to be, which is between parents and their children, students and their school nurses and counselors and adults that they trust. Kids need to be able to have these conversations about consent. Kids need to have accurate information to keep themselves healthy and to prevent teenage pregnancy. So that is that part of the bill. I'll turn it over to Representative Post and then tell you about the second half of the bill.
All right. Hi, committee, Vice Chair Knope and fellow members of the committee. Bill Post, House District 25. Really, I would say ditto. Except we just add this, the Salem-Keizer School District is in my House District, and so I was bombarded by both teachers and students via email and phone calls and Facebook posts and everything when this policy came out, and I kept going to them in the district and asking, if this was not a problem before, why is it a problem now? You know, and it was thrown back in my face, it's you, the legislature, that did this to us. And I of course, being the great fiscal conservative that I am, I thought, why are we going to waste legislative time to fix something for one school district? But apparently we need to. There is just enough, and I mean enough, ambiguity, I guess, that we need to clear it up a little bit. My concern, you know, obviously, and Senator Gelser has said it so well, I do not want to condone that kids have sexual activity. I think it's a horrible thing to do, not wise, long-term or short-term. So I'm not making a statement of we're giving the okay. I'm saying, you know what, it's going on. I think the CDC says 42% of kids are doing this, and it's probably more, but we're in that. That's the reality. I want kids to have a safe place to go to say, oh, I have a problem. And I have a vested interest. I'm married to her. She has kids come to her all the time, and she's now feeling this I'm supposed to report this? And it's consensual sex between two 16-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 17-year-olds. So this needs to be taken care of. Again, I'm really disappointed that we have to take care of this at the legislature, that we couldn't just work it out with the school district that was involved. But I think this is really important that we get this done. And I'm so glad that Senator Gelser just really jumped into this with both feet and allowed me to participate in some small way. It's important, and it's important for the kids, but it's important for the teachers too. It's really important for the teachers and other educators to be that trusted person that you can go to and say, I'm having a problem. I made a mistake, or I just need help, or whatever it might be. So it's protection for both the kids and the teachers, educators, et cetera. And because there may not be a safe place at home. I mean, you know, we all know the reality of life today. There's not always a safe place at home. Maybe a teacher is that one safe person you can go to. And I don't want teachers calling me saying, I have to report on my own kid. I mean, that was the part that really got me pretty upset. So anyway, thank you for the time, and I look forward to answering questions or just moving forward on this.
And the one other element that I wanted to make sure that we put out there as well, if we get to the point where we are making these reports to law enforcement or to child welfare, which of these kids that has been engaged in consensual sexual activity is going to live with the label of a sex offender for the rest of their lives? I mean, there are two outcomes to this that are pretty profound. Pregnancy, because we aren't giving kids access to good information, and somebody getting a label for a consensual activity that is entirely inappropriate. So on this piece, we're happy to answer any questions, and then I can tell you about the next piece.
Any questions?
No questions.
Please proceed.
Great. So the second piece of the bill, those of you, the two of you that were on the committee last time, will recognize AWAPI had asked for some clarification around definitions about their ability to investigate abuse. Some parts of that were very
explain AWAPI.
Thank you, Senator Mondes Anderson. So AWAPI is the Office of Adult Prevention, Protection and Investigation, and they investigate allegations of abuse in places like the Oregon State Hospital, in foster homes, adult foster homes, in child caring agencies, in a whole variety of places. So the Health Authority and AWAPI came to us last session, and Justin Hopkins is here. He can talk to you in more detail last session about the need for some clarifications. One, that AWAPI is the entity that does the investigations at the Oregon State Hospital. Secondly, we've changed the way that we deliver mental health services with kind of the implementation of our CCO structure. So the way that our abuse statute reads right now, it defines a vulnerable adult as a person who is receiving services from a community mental health program. Now an individual may have gone to the community mental health program, but the services might actually be delivered by a CCO or another entity that the community mental health program has contracted with. So we wanted to update the definition of what a community mental health program is. AWAPI also identified that individuals with mental health issues did not have the same protections as seniors, people with physical disabilities, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So this updates that. Where we ran into trouble last time was around that definition and how to appropriately tailor that definition of who a vulnerable person with a mental illness is. So in this bill, we narrow that to individuals in the community that are receiving community-based mental health services that have a severe and persistent mental illness. So these are individuals who are extremely vulnerable, who are requiring a lot of support on a day-to-day basis. It is not picking up individuals that have anxiety or depression, or they're going to see a counselor because of grief. It's just those that are severely and persistently mentally ill that kind of fall into that category of extremely vulnerable. We talked with the individuals that raised those concerns last time. They have no recommendations for the language and said that their concerns had been addressed by this change. The other change is that, and Justin is going to talk about this at length as well, our statutes did not cover individuals who were receiving residential treatment for substance abuse disorders. at the time that that individual is in an inpatient substance abuse treatment program, they are an extremely vulnerable individual. Really good example of this, this committee was well aware of the Eastern Oregon Academy, which was a child foster care entity. They lost their license due to issues related to pretty significant abuse and neglect. Last summer, they applied for a new license as a provider for adult men inpatient substance abuse, and the director of that entity told his local paper that one of the reasons it would look better, work better, was that there were less rules for how you could handle inpatient adults than there were for inpatient kids. That's a real problem. There were issues in Southern Oregon with OnTrack that went unchecked for a long time because OWAPI did not have the authority to do those investigations, and Justin is going to talk about that further. So this bill clarifies that individuals would be covered for that period while they are receiving treatment. Now, a really important clarification about this, the definition of abuse would only include that person while they're in treatment. So if I go into residential substance abuse treatment and I disclose a prior sexual assault or I disclose domestic violence, that does not trigger a mandatory abuse report that violates my confidentiality, because that did not happen while I was receiving services in that residential facility. So that is very, very narrow. And that is what that does.
Great. Any questions?
Great. Thanks. Thank you. I think Justin's next.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Gilser, Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. Nobody can ever remember exactly what the acronym is for, but also known as OWAPI. We're a shared service between the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. You gave such a robust description of the legislative concept. I'm just going to try to fill in some of the blanks and see if the committee has any questions. Really, the purpose of my testimony today is to provide you with additional information about the gaps that are in the existing abuse laws. As Chair Gelser mentioned, right now there is a very narrow definition because of the way that the healthcare system has changed in the last 5 to 10 years that excludes a lot of vulnerable Oregonians from the existing abuse protections in the law. So, as Senator Gelser mentioned, unless you're receiving services from a community mental health program, which has a pretty specific definition in an earlier part of the same statute, or you're receiving a mental health treatment in a licensed residential treatment facility, residential treatment home, or adult foster home, you're not protected by the existing definitions. So, what LC 120 does is it actually expands the definition of the vulnerable population to include individuals with a severe and persistent mental illness who are receiving services from really any regulated or funded program by the Oregon Health Authority. So that would include any services funded by a coordinated care organization, a community mental health program, or some provider that has a direct contract with the health authority. The LC also aims to shore up some discrepancies between the abuse provisions that apply to individuals with a developmental disability. In that same statute, there are protections for individuals with a developmental disability from abandonment, financial exploitation, verbal abuse, and certain types of neglect. Those same protections do not currently apply to individuals who have a mental illness. So LC 120 corrects that as well. We've also had some situations where there may be consensual sex between a somebody receiving a mental health service or a substance use disorder treatment service and their counselor, their professional. And LC 120 clarifies that sex abuse would extend to those situations. So if there's a professional relationship between a practitioner and a client, if there is even consensual sex between those two, that would still be considered sex abuse. Currently, licensing boards have ethical standards that they can enforce in those situations, but it's not considered abuse by the law. And lastly, as Senator Gelser mentioned, LC 120 would expand the definition for the population to individuals who are receiving substance use disorder treatment in a residential setting. As you mentioned, there have been a number of incidents around the state where pretty egregious actions by staff toward the clients, the residents. And while licensing from the Oregon Health Authority has been able to follow up on some regulatory issues, law enforcement can follow up if there is a crime that has been suspected to have been committed. There really isn't any meaningful ramifications for that alleged perpetrator as far as abuse goes. So some of the examples that we've seen in the recent past in residential facilities for people who are receiving substance use disorders, withholding a client's medications simply because they were late to show up. So, and sometimes that would include Suboxone, methadone, pretty serious actions. Physically assaulting clients by hitting or kicking them before they're allowed to go outside. We've had allegations of a staff member sexually assaulting a client, and while that was referred to law enforcement, there's really been no ability for meaningful follow-up from the department. Forcing clients to assault each other as part of their group therapy sessions. We had a karate chopping process in a group. Several complaints were received, and again, the health authority is able to follow up a little bit from a regulatory perspective, but there's really no investigation into the individual who is requiring that. Punitively forcing a client with a physical disability to go up and down stairs. And then we've also had several reports of financial exploitation over the years from specific staff members or also from the provider themselves. These are all examples of areas where if LC 120 does turn into a bill and is successfully implemented into law, these are all areas that would be investigated as formal abuse allegations. So I'll stop there and see if the committee has any questions. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Are there any questions? I just had one other thing that I had promised to put on the record. If my brother lives with me and has a mental illness and he decides not to take his medication and I have not been identified as his guardian, you know, he still has the right to make those decisions. Could I be accused of neglect for that?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, no, not under the current proposed language here. So folks will still have the right to self-determination and independence. Those situations are really looking if a paid caregiver has neglected their responsibilities.
Thank you. Any other questions? Nope, seeing none. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on LC 120? No, so this bill will be filed later today. We're going to post it for a hearing work session on the first day. So if you have other concerns, please get them out there. But this was a public hearing. We are not hearing any opposition, it appears. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 120 and move back to the informational meeting on the update on deaf and hard of hearing services related to child welfare in Oregon. And just as a little bit of background, I know Senator Mona Sanderson had received some questions about a situation where some parents were deaf. There were allegations of abuse. They requested a sign language interpreter, a non-certified interpreter came, and they were surprised later when they found out what they had allegedly said as a part of the investigation because they had not had access to an appropriate interpreter. We all brought this to the attention of DHS. I believe that the allegations themselves were reinvestigated with an appropriate investigator, but more importantly, a group was put together to look at what the policy is around access to appropriate sign language interpreters. So we were looking for an update on where that is going and how we are ensuring that we're complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so we'll start with Chad Ludwig, who is here in his personal capacity today.
Hello, everyone. Madam Chair, Senator Sarah Gelser, Vice Chair Senator Kim Tim Canope, and members of the committee. My name is Chad A. Ludwig, and I'm taking personal leave from my place of employment to represent myself as an advocate for the deaf and hard of hearing community. I would like to disclose that as of the new year, I've begun work at the Oregon Department of Human Services as an analyst for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Unit, and I'm very happy to be here with you today as I miss working with you all. In recent months, we have seen some high-profile examples of what happens when there are insufficient or vague standards for those who function as sign language interpreters. In November in Florida, law enforcement announced that they had captured the alleged serial killer of Seminole Heights, who was accused of having murdered four people. One victim had a deaf mother. During this time of unspeakable tragedy, the mother had little access to the information and support someone else would have received. Her interpreter, provided by an ill-informed system, was not qualified and, in fact, is alleged to have had a long history of deceit. Here in Oregon, the deaf and hard of hearing people in our community have shared with me the times they have encountered interpreters unfit to play the role. Through my volunteer advocacy work with Oregon Association of the Deaf, I've heard countless stories about interpreting services, excellent and poor. Excellent services are thanks to dedicated professionals who take their work seriously and engage in professional development. When services are poor, however, even grossly inadequate, deaf and hard of hearing individuals fear failing their classes or miss that opportunity to get their dream job. They fear fatally misunderstanding their doctor's directions or being cut off from care providers while their loved one passes away in front of them. There are some Oregon state employees, who have volunteered to interpret outside of their primary role, despite having no training nor certification in interpretation. They have attempted to interpret in serious situations, a welfare investigation, a police interrogation, a medical evaluation, forensic investigations, implementation of a family plan, and meetings with various representatives who had authority to determine the fate of vulnerable children, adults, and families. Frequently, those hiring interpreters cannot evaluate whether someone claiming to be an interpreter is qualified for the job. Absent external markers such as certification, they rely on self-attestation. The example from Florida shows how harmful that model can be. A would-be interpreter may confuse knowing some signed words with fluency and an ability to interpret, which are vastly different skills. When there's a member of the family who is deaf, Oregon DHS Child Welfare is required to provide accessible and effective communication. Federal and state legislation, including the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, and ORS 659A, requires state and local governments and private providers to ensure communication and equal opportunities for deaf individuals. The law defines the qualifications of an effective interpreter as someone who is able to interpret effectively, accurately, and impartially, both receptively and expressively, using any necessary specialized vocabulary and communication modalities. When we talk about qualifications, the widely accepted standard is national certification through the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf, which demonstrates having attained the minimum knowledge and skills required for the job. Most professional interpreters attain certification after studying interpretation formally. In Oregon, Portland Community College offers a 2-year diploma and Western Oregon University a bachelor's and graduate degrees in interpreting. About 30 states currently license their ASL interpreters, and 3 states are actively working with their legislature to implement licensure with the strong backing of their deaf and hard of hearing communities. Oregon does not license its ASL interpreters. This lack of basic protection is harmful to the vulnerable children, adults, and families who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. They have suffered tremendously due to misunderstandings, miscommunications, and misrepresentations that would not be typical of professional interpreters. This leads to emotional and physical trauma and the dangers of being exploited by those individuals who falsify their role as a certified, trained, and qualified interpreter. Providing unqualified interpreters can cost the state in later mental health counseling, vocational rehabilitation services, services for the developmentally delayed, and correctional services, to name a few. From my vantage point as a deaf community member, I see considerable distrust of state agency employees. Some deaf and hard of hearing people here have sworn off DHS despite needing its services. I consider this a failure of the system. We need to recognize the dignity of American Sign Language, ensure that interpreters being used are trained, qualified, and certified to work, and provide cultural sensitivity training for employees so that DHS can achieve greater effectiveness in service delivery, especially in the area of child welfare. When I think back to the stories that members of the deaf and hard of hearing community have shared with me, I wonder how they can gain closure and obtain services for their traumatic experiences. There is no place here in Oregon for deaf and hard of hearing individuals and their families to get access to professional mental health care services, advocacy, case management referrals, or other services in their native language, American Sign Language. This community is close-knit and often will depend on each other for advice and recommendations on whom to work with and whom to avoid. If anyone who is unqualified is allowed to perform the role of interpreter, even though they may be volunteering, I predict greater distrust and fear in the deaf and hard of hearing community. It breaks a necessary bond of trust within the community. There are currently no measures in place against this eventuality. I would like to ask you, our senators, to require DHS child welfare and all other programs and services offered by DHS to require appropriate and qualified language interpreters for vulnerable populations, such as the deaf and hard of hearing community. To do so will minimize misunderstandings and maximize effective communication, leading to positive results. The first step for all DHS staff in the investigation of a family with a deaf or hard of hearing person should be to evaluate the language and communication needs of the family. Only qualified individuals should be allowed to perform this evaluation, and qualification should include fluency in ASL. It should not be acceptable for a DHS staff person who has worked with deaf individuals but does not have fluency in ASL and other communication modalities to perform language and communication needs assessments. The evaluation will determine the type of communication access needed, such as whether and what kind of interpreters are required, such as certified hearing ASL interpreters and certified deaf interpreters. I strongly recommend dispatching a team of certified hearing ASL interpreter and a certified deaf interpreter to meet with the family every time a language communication needs assessment is conducted to help the DHS worker identify and develop the family plan. In conclusion, having policies in place with accountability for DHS workers is critical to ensuring that deaf individuals receive equal treatment by DHS and that children are protected. There is a serious need for attention to the training of DHS staff and contractors and coordination with Oregon Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, ODHHS. Please feel free to call me back here again anytime. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Any questions? No? Great. Thank you so much, Chad. All right. Next, we have Lori Price and Emmys Perfecto. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good
Good morning. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair, Senator Canope, members of the committee. My name is Lori Price, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Child Welfare Program here in Oregon. Thank you for the invitation to come and testify before you this morning. As you know, I can't speak about any specific or individual cases on the child welfare system or in any arm of the department, but I can speak to you in general terms about what our policy is and the work that we've been doing in this particular area that Chad spoke about with you this morning. It's very important to the department as a whole to ensure access to appropriate communication services to everyone we serve. We know there are some challenges, and we're working to improve in this area. Best practice is to always have an interpreter, an appropriate interpreter, whether it's ASL or any other language. And our policy specifically around sign language interpreters currently states that we have the responsibility to provide qualified sign language interpreters when necessary to provide effective communication. The use of anyone, such as a client's friend, family member, or a DHS employee who is not a qualified sign language interpreter, will be considered only on a short-term or temporary emergency basis when two things happen: when the need is immediate and there's not time to secure the services of a qualified interpreter, or there will be an unreasonable delay in providing services. Our Office of Equity and Multicultural Services, or OEMS, we're full of acronyms at the department, is currently working on the language access policy. And at this point, I will turn this over to my colleague, MSA Perfecto from OEMS, to provide details about the work we've been doing in this policy area and other tools and training for our staff to assure appropriate and timely access to interpreter services for our clients.
Thank you, Lori, Senator Gelser, and Vice Chair Canope, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emma Shea Perfecto. I'm the REAL Plus D, another acronym, Language Service Manager for DHS, Office of Equity and Multicultural Services. The role of the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services is really to provide a consultation and assist the DHS programs in making sure and ensuring cultural and linguistic competency throughout the agency. This allows us to meet our agency's values and fulfill our agency's missions and measured equitable results for our clients. In response to a demonstrated procedural and service gap, that's when OEMS, the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services, has been working to develop language access policies, as well as identify best practices to ensure that all clients, including deaf and hard of hearing clients, receive the services in languages and formats which best meet their needs. So in addition, I'd like to go through some of the activities just in the last approximately six months since June that we've engaged to try to address some of these issues that have come up. For example, in June, we began statewide training where we contracted with Dr. Denise Thew Hackett, who's here today from Western University. She did 12 sessions in 6 locations across the state to really talk about just general deaf culture as an introduction to our workers and to better understand this community and to start closing those gaps. Then we followed up with a contract with Western as well to look at our workers that can sign and making sure that they're proficient for the work that they're doing as they're doing their daily work, that we can guarantee that when they are practicing or signing, that it is efficient for the clients and clear. Then in August, we began to demonstrate, and we worked with Western, again with Denise Sue Hackett, as well as the Oregon Registry for Interpreters for the Deaf, to review video remote interpreting. The intent for video remote interpreting is kind of that emergency use. It is intended for quick contact. It is available for any device that has a camera on it. And so if we have somebody that walks in, if we need to get someplace and we can't get an in-person interpreter immediately, it's really just for those uses. And there's a lot of policy in place to ensure that. In August, we also developed we began development and approval for what we're calling the language easy button. My intent here is for all of our employees, they have large caseloads and we all know they're busy. I don't want them having to look through our intranet to find how to get these services. So it's literally, I've been calling it the easy button. I'm sure I have to come up with a better name, but the intent is they can, it's on their desktop, it'll be pushed out to everybody. They can then quickly access how do I get an interpreter, even if they're new employees, what are the policies around this, what training is available, what if I need translation, what if I need alternate format, what are the things and examples and modules and all those things will be attached to this site, so they'll have easy access to that. Then let's see, in August we kicked off, or in September we kicked off this tour, and I went across the state and I delivered a cross-cultural communication training that is half a day for our employees that really breaks down all the communication barriers that can happen for our clients and really breaks down what things that we need to do, whether it's cultural, whether it's developmental disabilities, what things are causing those barriers for our clients to receive the equitable service they need from our staff, and how to identify those and what things they can do and what tools are available to them to better provide those services. And so then, let's see, the other thing that we did in September was we brought together all programs, and we had them sit at a table and as a work group and look at our policies. We went through the internet, our intranet, pulled down all the policies from every program area, compared notes, and basically started working on a policy around language access and all of these services, and how we work with bilingual workers, how we're addressing the needs of the clients, and wrote a policy that's going to be enterprise-wide. And right now we're working with our community partners to have them take a look at the policy and make sure that we haven't missed anything. Then in October, we started piloting the video remote interpreting, and we did it in Beaverton and in Yamhill and Polk County, so we could see the barriers and some issues that might come up for rural and metro. And they've been very pleased with it so far, because it's within 10 seconds you've got an interpreter. And it's not only sign language interpreter, there's 20-plus languages, spoken languages. And it's not an in-person interpreter, obviously, but they're able to read body language. They're really able to kind of pick up on more than just a telephonic interpreter. Then in November, we had a panel discussion in Eugene where we brought in community partners and really did another session talking about the deaf experience, really talking about the client needs and just that those cultural pieces that we don't always get to hear and talk about as a community. Then in November, and we've been doing this for quite some time, but every quarter I do a NetLink, so that way it's in studio. I get the opportunity to talk to people across the state, and I go through step by step, if I'm a worker, what do I do if I need an interpreter? What if I need an interpreter and I can't find that interpreter? Who do I call? What are the forms? If I need translation, something taped or recorded, what do I need to do? And I walk them through. It's kind of dry, but I still have them do that, and we've had really good attendance. And right now in January, we are starting our rollout for the video remote interpreting, and so we're communicating with all managers. We're going from the top down and going out and meeting these folks and talking to them about what video remote interpreting will do for our community, what it won't do. We're very specific around it is a short-term solution for quick interactions, and then they need to hire certified interpreters. We expect that by February that we'll roll out to all staff. And we're working to do targeted trainings as needed on some of these issues per office as requested. At this point, we've trained just on the deaf and hard of hearing awareness. We trained over 154 staff. the language service training, 160 staff just since June, and the cross-cultural communication training was 294 staff members. So as an office, we're committed to helping DHS programs with recruitment assistance to address the lack of qualified interpreters of all kinds statewide. And in the meantime, we are working to improve access and educate regarding interpreter use. That's a big piece. A lot of people don't really understand when interpreters need to come in. And we're really working hard to explain the difference between telephonic interpretation, languages, understanding, you know, what is when somebody speaks a language, they really understand it. What are some of the gaps? So we're working very hard with our staff to further that education. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have at this time. Thank you for letting me.
Thank you so very much. Senator Montes Anderson.
Just one issue. My greatest concern is if the interpreter in DHS may have a bias on how the situation is. And I've seen that with caseworkers, not with, you know, that it isn't a deaf person, but in other situations. So I don't know, in your training, you talk about biases that that the individual may have, because that is extremely important, too.
Right. That's actually a big focus on our in our bilingual or in our cross-cultural communication training about biases we see, biases we perceive. We work through that. However, we don't have anybody that's an interpreter that's hired on staff. So we have bilingual workers that can do their job in two languages. And we're actually, in our policy, really going through and identifying that they are not indeed interpreters. They don't have the skill set to be interpreters. They can do their job, and they've been tested to be proficient. And in the event that there's an interpreter needed for further, like, family meetings and some of the examples that you gave, they must hire certified interpreters from the vendors that we have on our list. So it's not that they aren't DHS workers.
Thank you. I was wanting a clarification to Ms. Price. You mentioned that access to a qualified interpreter is a best practice, and then described the policy of that's the best practice, but when someone's not available, you use someone else. How much definition is there to what is immediate and what is emergent? And then secondly, is access to a certified interpreter best practice, or is that actually a right guaranteed to Oregonians under the Americans with Disabilities Act in Section 504?
Thank you for your question, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. What I cited for you was the direct language from our policy that was last updated in 2006. That's the policy that Emma Shea and her team are working on improving upon, because that truly is all that exists as far as policy right now. In our procedure manual, our staff are directed to find language interpretation through the contractors available to the department right now. So it's an area, like I said, that there's much improved work going on in that area, but it is obviously a right through the American with Disabilities Act. It is an expectation at the department level that our staff do access appropriate language interpreter skills for the people that we serve, but our policy is exactly as I read it to you, and not as strong as it will be moving forward.
Great. Thanks for that sure. clarification. I think sometimes when language like best practice is used, that makes it seem like it's aspirational than that is the basic requirement that every Oregonian should expect. And I think the case that Senator Montes Anderson and I were aware of was just really an example of the worst case scenario when a person's rights are violated and how that impacts a child and a family and leads to a lot of misunderstanding, disruption to a family, and really injury to that family. Are there other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the informational hearing on the update on deaf and hard of hearing services related to child welfare in Oregon, and open up a public hearing on LC 104. Okay. Will you give a description?
Chair
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, LC 104 exempts child caring agencies that provide adoption placement services but do not provide care to children and that do not receive public funds from requirements to provide financial statements that have been reviewed by independent certified public accountant, CPA.
And this basically is a workload reduction thing for private agencies that we really have no business asking them for audits of their finances.
When no public funds are involved.
When no public funds are involved, mm-hmm. and there's no care being provided to the children.
And if there is a problem, I mean, it isn't the state. I mean, if there's a complaint, there are other avenues they can go through.
That is correct. Yeah. That is correct. The law would still allow the requirement of, through the Revenue Committee a couple of years ago, we created this tax compliance certificate, so the department could still request the tax compliance certificate, but that's a matter of going online and printing it out. It would no longer be requiring people to spend thousands of dollars to do that. Anybody want to be heard on LC 104? Nope. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 104. We'll also post this one for public hearing and work session on our first day. Try to get you all free early on in the session. And next we will open up a public hearing on LC 106.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee, LC 106 allows parents with an emotional illness, mental illness, intellectual or developmental disability, or other disability to retain parental rights if the court does not find any additional conduct or conditions seriously detrimental to the children.
Thanks, and I would clarify that a little bit. It basically just says you cannot remove a child solely on the basis that a person has a disability. There has to be an actual threat or an actual behavior that is related to that. This was our bipartisan bill. Every member of the committee last fall individually contacted me and asked if we could have a bill to do this. There was a lot of media around some children that had been removed from their parents in Redmond simply on the basis that the parents had a low IQ, and the courts within the last couple of weeks have found that the department erred and returned those children to their family. So this bill is intended to make sure that doesn't happen. In one of these cases, the child was away from his family for over 3 years, and the other baby was taken from the hospital and never got to go home. So we really have to address that issue. And do we have Bob Jundiff?
Thank you, Senator Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And Senator, you hit the nail on the head. The purpose of this bill is just to specify that a person's parental rights may not be taken away merely because the person has a disability, that behaviors or limitations that may result from a disability may certainly be considered. But the findings should not be based solely upon the identity of having a disability.
And colleagues, our statute currently starts out when it says what may be considered. The very first thing says an intellectual or developmental disability or a mental illness. There is nothing else that gets called out. So, for instance, if you could imagine the conversations we would have if we wanted to put in the statute that poverty could be considered if situations arising from poverty cause the danger to children. The issue should be, if someone has a mental illness, it's not that they have a mental illness, it's the behavior that they have towards the child. This would still allow that to take place, but it couldn't be, we're going to watch you more carefully because we know that you have been, because we know what your IQ is, therefore someone from the hospital is going to preemptively call before you've ever done or demonstrated some sort of an inability, and then you're going to have this intrusion on your life that you would not have if you did not have the label of that disability.
Senator Gelser, that's correct. And what it does in a sense is, in the way it's written, is it creates a presumption that once a disability is identified, now it's the parent's responsibility to overcome a presumption that that's a problem in terms of parenting ability. And what we're what we would hope the law would reflect, and we think that the overall legal environment shows through the Americans with Disabilities Act and other laws is that people with disabilities have the same rights in the process as everyone else, and that our laws shouldn't give at least an appearance of prejudice.
Exactly. And we do have in OLAS, we heard this in September, we heard this in November. We had the national expert come that was doing national model legislation. She testified by phone, that Rocking the Cradle, that talked about the disproportionate impact of child welfare intervention for individuals with disabilities. And the other thing that this law does, the language that's there mirrors the language that this legislature passed several years ago as it relates to child custody and parenting time. So when a pair of parents are disrupting that relationship either through a divorce or some other breakup of that domestic situation, this would put those same standards in place that we already have in the law for determining parental access to children. Any questions for Bob? No? And I just, tremendous gratitude to that judge and tremendous apologies to that family for the disruption that they went through on the basis simply that they had an intellectual disability. I cannot imagine losing my children on the basis of my intellectual disability or that I chose to give them chicken nuggets. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on LC 106? No? All right. We will also schedule this for a public hearing and a work session on the first day. We will close the public hearing on LC 106 and open up the work session to introduce the committee concepts.
Chair Gelser, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 104 dated 1-9-2018 and LC 106 dated 1-9-2018.
Senator Knope moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 104 dated 1-9-2018 and LC 106 dated 1-9-2018. Is there any discussion? Okay. Again, just to be clear, as per the February session, we move really fast in that first week. That's why we have public hearings in January and send these concepts around. It's great to have these moving forward with no opposition on the record from anyone for anything that we heard today. So hopefully we will be freeing up your time in February after the first day of session, or possibly the first Thursday of session. Is there any objection to the introduction of these committee bills? Seeing none, so ordered. Anything else for the good of the order? Well, at 9:30 a.m., we are adjourned.